All right, so before I begin with my talk, I do want to acknowledge my collaborators at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They're listed here, especially Jonathan Patz and Tracy Holloway at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment in Madison, along with Dr. Jason Bargo, Monica Harkey, and Paul Meyer, who have been a huge help in getting us this far. I don't have any relationships to disclose. I want to note that although I'm at EPA right now, this presentation is delivered in my capacity as an affiliate with the University of Wisconsin-Madison and doesn't reflect the views of the U.S. government. So I want to begin the talk by pulling up a figure from the National Climate Assessment. How many of you are familiar with this document or maybe have seen this figure before? All right, good. I'm happy to see that. For those of you who aren't familiar with the National Climate Assessment, it was published last May 2014, and was basically the product of the work of hundreds of scientists, more than 300 scientists, working collaboratively to establish the current state of climate science and what it means in terms of impacts for the United States, especially. When we talk about climate change for public health, a lot of times the first thing that comes to mind is temperature. And this figure here draws attention to the temperature situation around the globe over the past several decades. So the bars here align with the global temperature average between 1901 and the year 2000. And what you can see here is that for the past five decades, the average temperature has been progressively higher. And in fact, any of you who've seen the news lately, especially the last few weeks, note that 2015 is likely to be the hottest year since we've been keeping track of temperature records. This obviously poses grave risks to public health. Recently, we've seen huge impacts in terms of population health from heat waves. A lot of you are probably familiar with the 2003 event in Europe that is implicated in about 70,000 excess deaths, as well as the more recent 2010 heat wave in Russia, more recent ones in India this past summer, etc. So we know that heat waves in an acute way cause mortality in significant ways around the world. It's also important to note that chronic, longer-term exposure to higher temperatures also pose increasingly significant risks to population health, and that's something that we're going to get to a little bit later in the modeling work. The second environmental exposure that I want to concentrate on in my talk today is that of air pollution, which may not be one that a lot of people think of when they think of climate change, but it's actually, you know, closely related to climate. Ozone is the pollutant that I'll focus on today. Ozone is a secondary pollutant, so it's not emitted directly from a tailpipe or a smokestack, but rather formed secondarily in the atmosphere as a result of interactions amongst primary pollutants. I want to here differentiate between stratospheric ozone, which is protective for health, limits UV radiation that reaches the surface and, you know, protects us from skin cancer incidents especially. But tropospheric ozone is the bad ozone, the ozone smog that's relatively close to the surface and harmful to respiratory health especially. These two figures here draw attention to the problem of climate change and especially worsening ozone air pollution. Warmer weather favors the chemical formation of ground-level smog, and so it's been anticipated that as we see higher temperatures around the world, especially in urban areas that have high concentrations of these primary pollutants that form ozone, we will likely expect to see increasing concentrations of the smog that damages health. So this brings us to the question of our modeling work and what was really the focus of today's talk, and how will climate change affect how heat and air pollution affect health, especially when we consider these two exposures jointly. So a lot of times we are limited in our ability to assess the joint effects of environmental exposures, although people are outside breathing in a whole soup of air pollution, right? So it's not just ozone, it's particulates, it's lead, it's other primary pollutants, but they're also exposed to temperature at the same time. And so, although oftentimes in our modeling work and in our EPI studies, we are focusing on a particular pollutant of interest, we try to go a step further with some of this work and think about how these joint exposures, ozone and heat, might combine to be greater than the sum of their parts in affecting health. So I want to first focus on the independent risks posed by both heat stress and air pollution, then we'll sort of put them together at the end of the talk, and then hopefully have some time for discussion. I just wanted to draw attention to the climate assessment again, and note that extended periods of unusual heat now lasts longer than any living American has ever experienced. And I really want to draw attention to that National Climate Assessment if it's a document that you haven't seen, and really tying together the science and impacts for the United States especially. So my study and our study involved a whole lot of modeling, and I want to step you through sort of the sequence of models. I won't focus on the details, but we can definitely follow up in the Q&A with all of that. Basically, we start with a regional climate change scenario and work our way through forecasting of summer climate in just a section of the U.S., the eastern U.S., and then eventually at the end tied into health impact estimation. So there are different models that are spelled out here. The first one is the the North American Regional Climate Change Assessment Program, or NRCAP, which is run out of Boulder, Colorado, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And then we combine that with the Weather Research and Forecasting Model, or WARF, and then finish up with the VenMap model, which assuming maybe some of you are familiar with from earlier talks this week, which is basically the Environmental Protection Agency's basic model for health impact assessment, especially for air pollution, but has more recently been applied to risks associated with elevated temperatures. So just a little bit more about NRCAP, because it is the climate change scenario that sets up the rest of the analyses and the results that you'll see in this talk. So each of the NRCAP scenarios are based on IPCC Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change scenarios, which are sort of highlighted here. This is hopefully a figure that some of you are familiar with in terms of global temperature patterns in the past, with that black line diverging into the future, various colored lines depending on different emissions scenarios, right? So unfortunately, we are right now headed most closely to that red line, the A2 emission scenario, which gets us somewhere between 3 and 4 degrees centigrade warmer by the end of the century. So all of the NRCAP scenarios that we were working with to come up with our sort of assessment for the future are based on this A2 emission scenario. So that is important to note in sort of providing context to the health impact estimates that you'll see at the end of the talk. So in conducting health impact assessments, work in epidemiology, we need to have a reference point that makes sense. And so we chose, for a number of reasons that I won't get into now, but we can talk about later, 2007 as our baseline year for both temperature and air pollution scenarios. So this provides our point of departure. So all of the estimates that you'll see in terms of health impact changes are relative to the year 2007. So this map depicts sort of the extent of our study region. So it's the eastern U.S. pretty broadly defined. This is, I'll mention here, work that's tied into estimation of emissions from power plants and how those are affected by temperature, and that's other work that's a part of this. But that's why we chose this section of the U.S. in terms of the concentration, especially of coal-fired power plants that are sensitive to environmental conditions in terms of electricity demand. So here you see the temperature profile that's depicted for 2007. We can fast forward into the future and look at what things might look like in a mid-century scenario that's provided by that NRCAP recipe. So we've downscaled the NRCAP modeling, which is done on a 50-kilometer grid, down to a 36 and eventual 12-kilometer grid box here. So every dot that you see on this map represents a 12-kilometer square grid on temperature estimation. When we do the subtraction between our mid-century estimate and 2007, we anticipate substantial warming, so about 4.5 degrees in the apparent temperature metric, and then an increase of about 3 degrees centigrade in the minimum temperature experienced across the study region. Although you can see significant variation, right, depending on where you are in our map. So now I really want to connect it to public health since we're at APHA, and this is the VenMap model. I'll step through it real quickly. Hopefully there's time for questions if any of you want to talk about the model a little bit more. But VenMap is a useful tool, especially for integrated health impact assessment, because it allows us to integrate data across environmental and health domains. So this is the sort of recipe that we end up with in doing our work with VenMap. We start with baseline environmental exposures, whether they're temperature or later on you'll see air pollution. We combine that with population projections. We're looking into the future, so we need to think about where people will be living, right, at the middle of the century. Excuse me. We also need to know the baseline conditions, right? What sorts of conditions are people currently suffering from, and how might environmental changes affect incidents? The key in VenMap is these exposure response functions, which connect cause and effect. It's the basic epi that is involved in connecting temperature exposures to mortality or morbidity risks. When we put all of those together, we can come up with estimated health impacts, which are basically an annualized estimate of how many excess deaths, how many excess asthma cases, et cetera, we might see as a result of changing environmental conditions. It's worth noting that BenMap has gained prominence, especially lately. When you saw the Clean Power Plan rolled out earlier this year, you saw the White House touting how many excess deaths would be avoided by reduced pollution, right? And so it's models like BenMap that EPA runs to come up with those estimates and eventually attach economic valuation to the, you know, lives saved, et cetera. So in this first case, we're considering temperature changes. So that upper, you know, left yellow map is the temperature map that I showed you before, and combining it with mid-century estimates for the rest of the map. So these are the temperature results that we ended up with just using this is a sampling of the exposure response functions that we used for temperature. So you can see over the left, three EPI studies. Some probably of you in the room were involved in some of those studies. The age groups that apply to those. And you can see that by 2040, we end up with more than 240 million Americans in our entire study region. Almost 50 million of them are age 65 or older. Those folks, as you know, probably know, are especially vulnerable to temperature-related risks. So depending on which metric we use and which study we're looking at, we end up with somewhere between 58 and 8,800 excess deaths as a result of the increasing temperature alone across the study region. And the death rates are adjusted per 100,000 at the right side of the table. So that's sort of the heat estimate considered just in isolation. And we'll come back to this a little bit later. The second sort of branch of the study is to consider air pollution and climate, which is something we could spend days talking about, but I'll just summarize our work by talking about ozone. So I mentioned earlier that ozone is a secondary pollutant, right? It's formed in the atmosphere as a result of combinations of nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds. Nitrogen oxides are often the result of combustion of fossil fuels. Volatile organic compounds come from both human activities as well as natural sources. So there are what are called biogenic emissions of VOCs coming from plant life, basically, that are stimulated, unfortunately, by warmer weather. So it's anticipated that because we'll have higher temperatures, we're going to see both people burning more fossil fuel potentially and higher emissions of these biogenic precursors. So we might have an ozone problem that can really sort of spiral out of control. So I mentioned sort of the ozone problem. I do want to draw attention also to the problem of fine particulate matter and climate. It's not something that we're focusing on for this work here, but it's a part of our modeling that's part of the entire conversation about climate change and air pollution, because we anticipate, especially over the U.S., more frequent stagnant air masses, which promote the accumulation of fine particulate matter. These are the really tiny particles and condensed liquid droplets that can penetrate really deeply into our lungs and cause grave harm to health. So in terms of the health impacts here, the impacts of PM2.5 are, you know, orders of magnitude greater than they are for ozone. It's not something that we're talking about for this particular work here, but I don't want to, you know, proceed without mentioning that important effect. So the air pollution modeling approach looks much similar to the temperature modeling approach, except we've added this blue box, the future air pollution estimate, using the CMAQ model, which is another EPA model used for air pollution analyses. This is the community multi-scale air quality model. This is especially Tracy Holloway's area of expertise at Madison. So it's a similar modeling approach using the same setup, the same scenario that we use for the temperature approach. So it's a kind of baked into the same modeling. So again, we start with 2007 as our baseline year of analysis for ozone. You can see the distribution of the pollutant across the study region here. Again, we fast forward into the future with our mid-century estimate, doing the photochemical modeling and looking at how temperature stimulates ozone formation across the region. So this is considering no change in anthropogenic patterns of ozone precursor emissions. So we're not considering any changes in transportation or power plants, anything. This is just the climate change effect isolated. So when we run the math here, we can come up with a difference estimate. We estimate about 15 parts per billion increase on average across the study region in ozone concentrations. This is significant. The National Ambient Air Quality Standard for ozone was just lowered right to 70 parts per billion. So this represents a pretty big chunk of ozone that could get away with us, away from us without any policy intervention change. So again, we can run the numbers through BenMap. This time, instead of using exposure response functions for temperature, we're considering ozone effects. And I'll show the effects here for PM2.5 also. And basically, the result is somewhere on the order of magnitude similar to the heat effect, right? 8,800 excess deaths for ozone. The thing for ozone is we can also do morbidity effects. So we're looking at changes in the number of acute respiratory symptoms, ER visits, hospital admissions for asthma attacks, et cetera. So these are significant increases, right, in the air pollution-related burden of disease just due to climate alone. We're not considering any change in human behavior that might affect anthropogenic emissions. So we've considered now both the air pollution and heat effects in isolation, but now the next piece is to look at interactive effects between heat and ozone. And there are a range of studies, of course, that have considered how exposures to heat and ozone might combine to be greater than the sum of the parts. I will say that there's a whole lot of literature out there. We sort of focused on just a few studies to include in our modeling. There's disagreement about whether air pollution should be considered an effect modifier or a confounding variable in these air pollution models. And of course, it's very difficult to isolate the effect of a specific air pollutant on health, right, when people are exposed, like I said earlier, to many things all at once. But roughly, for those of you who may not be familiar with the concept of effect modification, it's basically that when we see higher levels of both exposures, we might expect the sum of these exposures to be greater than the independent effects alone. This is sort of a simplified diagram showing you how effect modification could work for temperature and ozone, because we know that on the warmest days, we are likely to see the highest ozone concentrations. And so we're aiming to evaluate the air pollution-related burden of disease on those especially hot days. I'll note here that the categories are sort of a two-by-two sort of simplified situation, but we did run a little bit more complicated situation where we consider ozone and temperature broken down into a little bit more finer scale. So the interactive effects are shown here. So we've basically broken down our analyses into quartiles. So the ozone increases, which I mentioned are 15 parts per billion on average, actually reach 20 parts per billion in the highest quartile. And you can see that those temperature increases closely align with the quartiles, and that makes sense, right? We see the highest ozone concentrations on the warmest days. We can run independent estimates of what that means for air pollution and heat-related burdens, and those are roughly in line with what we saw earlier in terms of roughly 5,000-6,000 deaths attributable to each alone. The results for the interaction are about an order of magnitude lower. So we estimate about 280 excess deaths from the combined effects of heat and ozone across the region. Of course, these are concentrated, especially in urban areas, and I'm still kind of working on the spatial analyses of these. But basically, we do end up with about a 2% extra accounting of excess deaths due to this interactive effect. And that's an important thing to consider when we talk about the economic effects and value of a statistical life incorporated into the effects. It's important to sort of consider that we don't want to be double counting here, though, too, right? So there may be a situation in which we've kind of overestimated, and so we're hoping to kind of nail down and run more interactive models to understand exactly what we can isolate to the interactive effect. So the key points from this work are that we anticipate pretty substantial warming across the eastern United States into the mid-century, which triggers worsening summer ozone air pollution between June, July, and August. It's important to consider here that only the direct effects of warming and not the indirect effects of behavior change on emissions are considered here. In terms of the order of magnitude, the seasonal heat-related mortality is on par with the ozone impacts, and the interactive effects between heat and ozone are significant, but about an order of magnitude lower than the independent effects of these exposures. In terms of limitations, there's two categories that I want to highlight, although I could talk for a while about this. So in terms of exposure assessment, the temporal resolution of our model is limited. We're considering a whole summer in the future, which actually takes a whole lot of time for these computer models to kind of churn through. So we're looking at June, July, and August chronic exposures to elevated temperatures and ozone, although we know that the population health impacts are likely occurring on a more acute time scale, right? The spatial resolution, as I mentioned, here is on a 12-kilometer grid, which is pretty good in terms of where we've been in terms of climate downscaling and exposure estimates, but it's still not good enough. And again, it's a computational limit largely that leaves us in this situation. I do also want to point out that we're limited by the starting climate scenario that we selected from NARCAP, and there was a choice there that was made. We could have chosen any number of other scenarios, and we're still working to consider sort of other ones that we might use to constrain our estimates a bit better, and also running the estimates for PM2.5 pollution. In terms of ozone and heat, it's also really important to consider especially vulnerable populations, and we're limited in our ability to use the BenMap model to estimate those specific risks in terms of people who are already afflicted with disease and have comorbidities, and those very young and very old who might be especially vulnerable to this interactive effect. It's also important to note that we will hopefully see a lot of behavioral adaptations and policy interventions to get us to a different point by the middle of the century in terms of what these exposures look like. So with that, I do want to acknowledge our primary funding agency, which is NIH and the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, our collaborators at UW-Madison, especially those at the Wisconsin Energy Institute and the Energy Center of Wisconsin. I don't know if we have time for questions now, or maybe I'll wait. Okay. Awesome. Thank you.